Support for this program comes from Jazz on the Tube, the Internet's largest collection of free streamable classic jazz videos. From Miles Davis to Louis Armstrong, from Thelonious Monk to Duke Ellington, you'll find it all on jazzonthetube.com. Start your free subscription today.
Hi, and welcome to Jazz Talk, a Jazz on the Tube podcast. My name is Ken McCarthy, and this is where we talk with people who are doing important work that supports and illuminates the music we love. The writers, the scholars, the educators, the filmmakers, the producers, and more. And today we're going to be talking with Jake McGinsky. Jake, welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Jake has got, I'm going to say, amazing new film out, and we're going to be talking about that. It's based on the life of the ongoing life of a great artist, Milford Graves, drummer, percussionist. And this is a great film on a lot of different levels. One, it documents one artist's life, which is always a good thing. But I think it also highlights something really important, that there are a lot of musicians who are multidimensional people. And it's very rare that anybody captures that. And this film, which has a really unique name, I'm going to ask you about that in a second, this film captures that. And I hope, besides educating people about Milford Graves and his work, it also just educates people that there's a lot more to our musicians than we realize. You know, there's a lot going on behind the scenes. So tell us about, if you wouldn't mind, the title.
Yeah, the title, Milford Graves' Full Manthus is the full title. And the Full Manthus part of the title has to do with a story that Milford recounts in the film, and I've also heard on many other occasions, about the kind of beginnings of a martial art that he invented in the 60s called Yara. And the story goes, it's, you know, Professor Graves was already a, you know, citywide champion in boxing as a kid and was studying various martial arts in the 60s, as were a bunch of people in his neighborhood, and he was kind of already assuming the role of teacher. And there was a garage in his grandfather's house that was the dojo that's featured in the film as well. And the story goes that several of the people he was working with and training with were going to Chinatown to get training in Chinatown in New York City, and were getting turned away from various classes and various styles because they're being told that those particular martial arts styles were not available to non-Chinese. And one day, one of his friends went down to the city from South Jamaica, Queens, where they were living, and went to go to the Amantha style class and was turned away and came back. And the professor, you know, basically says he thought about it for a while and was reading books on Chinese martial arts. I came to the realization that all the great masters of the art were paying attention to nature, were sitting alone in the woods and coming up with these forms. So he figured he would do that too. So he found a science book and ordered some praying, science magazine, and ordered praying mantis eggs. And they hatched them in the yard, and they studied the movement directly from the praying mantis itself. So the metaphor there was really going straight to the source, cutting out any middlemen. Anytime another human being wants to kind of cut you out or keep information from you, that you always have kind of access to both your own body, to nature, to the sensorial experience. And these are the time-tested sources of inspiration for many of the great art forms of the world. So that story, you know, is a captivating story in itself, and it's recounted visually and in the film. But it's also, you know, the basic instruction for filmmaker to kind of stick right to the source, to not to not try to analyze or bring other people in to analyze the experience, but to really pay attention to what's happening in front of you and to use that as kind of basic way of structuring the film. I'd also say that you see this metaphor in all the other parts of Professor Graves' creative process. So, you know, when he's doing heart music, he's going straight to his heart and sonifying those rhythms and those sounds and using that as the substance for music in his garden. He's operating the same way, watching plants, using the plants as inspiration. So this kind of going straight to the source idea seemed like the right title for the film. And, you know, we kind of, the title came and then it just stuck. And now I think now Full Mantis represents more than just the particular story. It kind of represents the whole cosmology.
Yeah, the attitude towards learning. And it is a radical, I mean, for our society where, you know, you're supposed to go to school and somebody's supposed to dish it out to you, you know, in measured quantities, and you're supposed to stay on the track. That's one way of going through life. And then the other way is the way Professor Graves is showing us. And by the way, we should point out, we're not just throwing that word professor around. Milford Graves was a professor was it Bennington?
Yeah, Bennington College. He's Professor Emeritus now, and he taught there for about 40 years.
40 years. So he was one of the pioneers of bringing jazz education to what we call academia.
Yeah, I think that's definitely true. I mean, Bennington is kind of a unique place inside academia, very experimental college in general. And Milford, I think, came there in around 1971. So he was there for quite a long time. And, you know, one of the beautiful and unexpected parts of making this film has just been connecting with the just hundreds and hundreds of students all around the world that either came through Bennington or came through the house in South Jamaica, Queens as students and have gone on to become neurosurgeons and lawyers and politicians and doctors and health food store owners and athletes, and have kind of all brought, they all have a piece of Milford's teachings inside their life. And the film, at least from my perspective, I got to meet a lot of these people of all different generations because he's been a teacher for so long. So there's kind of an interesting community growing, and we're all connecting with each other kind of through the film, which has been a real blessing.
That's great. So it was a community building enterprise as well as making a film. And before we go on, about this martial arts aspect to his life, he developed a pretty formidable art too.
Yeah.
You know, pretty, you know, and martial arts is one of those things that, you know, people will test you. And if you're not able to deliver, you know, it's an unpleasant experience. And I don't have any direct experience of Professor Graves' martial arts, but I have heard that he was formidable and it's a formidable art that he developed.
Indeed. And this was not an art that was just done, you know, only inside the space of his dojo. I mean, these were the way they were training. And I've now been exposed to many, many tapes from the history, working on another project now I can't say too much about. But this is like MMA 20 years before MMA. I mean, they were experimenting with different styles and combining different styles and really putting this stuff into practice through a regimen of both training and sparring. So yeah, it was no joke. And this was real stuff. And you know, I think that's another interesting metaphor that you find in the film that's inside the martial art is, you know, for people, for creative people, and I think for all human beings, it's like, like you were mentioning before, the dominant strains of pedagogy and teaching in our society and how you go into a career, we're very much part of a specialized culture that really favors specialization. But, you know, that's not necessarily the way it works and has worked in the past. And so for Milford, you know, martial arts can function as a source of inspiration, as fuel for the music, as a way of self-defense and self-protection, you know, and as an art that's developing, you know, alongside other martial arts in the context of sparring. So it can have multiple functions. In the same way the garden can be a source of inspiration creatively, it's also a site for nourishment, you know, and a symbol can be a ride symbol that's creating a pattern. It can also on stage become a hat, you know, and it's this kind of way of looking at what you have access to in a creative way and kind of taking each thing in a deep, deep way without projecting kind of narratives onto it, this emergent way of creating, an emergent way of learning that I think the film really tries to get at. I think in many ways it's a film about kind of the mysteries of creative process with someone mm-hmm. who's really compelled to try to explain those mysteries. You know, you don't meet many artists who are going to really try to explain the way all these things are related, the way, you know, the way that the sensorum, the five-part harmony relates to sound, the way the Milford experiences his own physiology and his nervous system and how that relates to minor keys and major keys. These are real things that are influencing the way he puts together his music and his life, and he's actually completely generously willing to share them with the audience. So it seemed really appropriate to try to put the audience in that position where they could kind of receive those teachings directly rather than have them be anecdotes inside a historicized kind of narrative of someone's career through a discography or, you know, talking about what sidemen they had and other ways that film explores a musical life. It seemed like for this person, it was much more powerful to kind of go directly into the creative process and let the film emerge out of the different ways that creativity was working.
Gotcha. So you really you experience more of the essence of the man and his way of working, his way of being, as opposed to, you know, he was born here and he did this and he did that. You know, when you think of in history, great minds, like I'm thinking of Goethe, who is a poet and a scientist. A lot of people don't know he was a scientist as well. And then you think of the Renaissance, where people would be engaged in all kinds of arts, not just, they wouldn't drill down and just focus on one thing. And then the great Islamic scholars, you know, of the, you know, that preceded the Renaissance. And it wouldn't be unusual for a guy to be an astronomer, a mathematician, a doctor, and a geographer, you know, yeah. on a high level. You know, it just wasn't unusual. And then, of course, in the classical times, you have someone like Pythagoras. We don't know a whole lot about him, but we know that in addition to being interested in philosophy, he was very interested in music and tones. So this stream of human being has been around for a long time, but is scarce in our society today, and I just can't tell you how important I think this kind of a film is to show that there is an other way to be. Hey, I wonder, speaking of biography, people are going to be interested in you know, details of his birth and where he grew up. And one of the things I find interesting is, because I'm a big lover of Latin music, that his original entry into music was through Latin music. And he started out as a big fan of Tito Puente, and which would have gotten him involved in a kind of a different approach to rhythm than is typical in jazz. It's a more, I always tell people it's a very disciplined approach to rhythm. It's a interlocking approach where everybody is, a lot of different people are involved. It's not just the drummer. Everybody's kind of a rhythm musician in a Latin band, no matter what instrument you're playing, and it all has to fit together as a group. Can you tell us a little about, you know, where did he grow up and you know, the sort of this kind of run of the mill details about his life?
Yeah, I mean, and I'll say also that the film does address those things in different kinds of ways, and I think in cinema form. So, you know, there is a scene in the beginning of the film where the professor talks about growing up in the 40 projects, which are the housing projects in South Jamaica, Queens, and it comes with the kind of shots of where the Long Island Railroad and the end mm-hmm. of the J meet up, and and also the beginnings of the house. And before that scene, there's a scene of the professor playing a shiko drums in his basement. I don't know if you remember that scene, but he's playing rhythm rumba wawang ko. That's the first contemporary scene you see. And it's part of this opening sequence in the film where there is no dialogue. I've been asked about that several times in talkbacks. And, you know, one of the things that I always say is that, you know, the percussion is dialogue in this film as well. It's not only in words. And it seemed important to have that element of storytelling introduced early in the film. And what you see in that sequence is it's actually a really intimate shoot. It's shot in the professor's basement, hot summer day, and he kind of is oscillating between performing kind of physically and in silence and moving and dancing, and then going into the typical rumba wawang ko pattern, which is a folkloric rhythm. It's also the basis for so much Afro-Latin music arrangement and the way that the bass and drums work, but it comes from conga music. And, you know, that there's about a 5-minute sequence of him performing that as one of the first pieces of music you hear. And essentially that represents in the film that part of the drum lineage. So, well, Milford would tell it better than me, but I can say, you know, what I know, which is, I think the history of diasporic music, African diasporic music, is not something that's completely told or part of mainstream knowledge and mainstream narratives about the way that jazz works and the way that music works. I think there's probably many more surprises than not when as far as the way I, you know, understood music previously, American music previously, to being exposed to kind of deeper strains of drum culture. I think it's much different when you get on the ground, especially in neighborhoods where this music was being formed and created. There's a lot more range of dialogue between musicians and cultures than one might think. But I think what it comes down to is Milford was drumming at a very early age. He grew up in apartment buildings where there were lots of other musicians, including Cuban family close by that came from a very heavy lineage of drummers. So he was drumming in multi-part folkloric style drumming from a very early age. And that was the kind of drumming that kind of turned him on. Like that's what he was interested in. So when he was a band leader since 19 years old, he brought Chick Corea in from Boston to play in his Afro-Latin band, and they opened for Tito Puente.
Later.
Yeah. And, you know, I think when you hear him play now, you hear a lot of those same patterns in the drumming. You hear 12-8, the classic pattern from Afro-Latin music in a lot of what he does. And I don't think in many ways he's ever left that tradition. He applied it to kind of another context. And I think when he first sat down on the drum kit in that context, that's, you know, part of the reason it was so powerful is because he carried this very deep stream of drum culture in his body. And when he applied that to the drum kit, it was like nothing that anyone had ever heard before. The joke of like when the African drummer comes to the U.S., they say like to the drummer, well, where are all your friends? You know, so Milford was playing these multi-part rhythms by himself on the drum kit. Rhythm, you know, he knew all the parts. For the, like you said, very disciplined, complex, highly developed rhythmic concept was something he was bringing. So, and I think that's something that's actually an interesting point in itself, is that I've heard people talk about avant-garde jazz or free jazz or improvised music as kind of a deconstruction of something. And I think that's kind of the antithesis of what Milford is, which is it's really about emergence. He wasn't playing anything on the drum kit to try to destroy something else. He was kind of putting things in play inside the dynamic forces of improvisation and letting them grow rather than kind of deconstructing, you know, typical idiomatic drum patterns from bop. He was essentially activating an extremely rich and complex history of drumming inside the context of a quartet or a trio.
Mm-hmm.
And really bringing the drum set forward on the stage into on the same level as the other instruments, rather than being a timekeeper, allowing the drums to have that same range of expression and take up as much space inside the music as other instruments.
I was lucky to spend some time with Jerome Cooper, who another drummer who didn't, and he would talk to me about this a lot. He said, you know, the drummer doesn't belong in the back of the bus, you know, and that's kind of how traditional classic jazz quartet is set up. The horn player's up front, the piano player off to the side, and the drummer in the back. And during this period of time, in the 60s, the 70s, and then onward, I think the drumming has come more to the fore. And I was also lucky to have spent a fair amount of time in Cuba. And that's where you really get it, at least for me. It's one thing you hear it, you know, performance, and it's, you know, it moves you. But when you're in a society where that really is the thing, you know, it's not an exotic kind of music. It is music, and everybody's involved in it. Maybe they just hit a bell or they hit the clave, but everybody joins in. You know, the whole group, everybody around is part of the scene, and they're all part of the rhythmic complexity. And I feel that when I see Milford play, that is welling up, that original, for lack of a better word, original tradition of drumming. I don't mean traditional drumming, but that original attitude towards drumming is just sort of welling up through the drum set and through him.
I would totally agree. And I would say, even, you know, to go further, I think those rhythmic concepts that are alive inside drum cultures like Cuba, these are highly, highly developed systems, you know. And
yeah,
even when you talk about, like, the bell is the clave, you know, there's a saying in Cuba, la llave es la clave, la clave es la llave. But that word, clave, the way it's written in Spanish, it means key, but not key like to open a door. It means key the same way we say key for tonal system.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really what clave is. That's what those patterns are. They're systems of intervallic relationships that offer, you know, areas of tension and release, not unlike a harmonic system or a tonal system of a scale. You know, they're patterns that have emerged out of musical culture and been developed by geniuses of generation after generation after generation after generation. So these systems they're alive, they're complex, and they're highly, highly advanced systems of music that when you get involved, you recognize that what's going on rhythmically is just as complex as anything that's happened in the tonal system inside Western art music.
Absolutely. And it's a great, wonderful discovery for those of us that were not raised in that tradition to discover, wow, there's this whole other world, and it's deep, and it's profound, and it's serious, and it's multidimensional. And, you know, to the extent that we're willing to put ourselves into it, we can learn some of it, we can integrate it into what we're doing. It's a great treasure of humanity, you know. So people can research Milford Graves's musical pedigree, you know, the fact that he, you know, the quartet with Roswell Rudd and Reggie Workman,
mm-hmm.
and it's John Chakai,
yeah, for New York Art Quartet,
yeah, sure. and then his work with Paul Bley. And all the other great names, people can look into that. I'm more interested in his other work, at least for the purpose of this call, because I think it'll surprise people. For example, you've talked about his garden. He's not only a person that loves plants and studies them, but he's also an herbalist. So he's someone that uses plants in healing. What do you know about the system? You know, does he have a, did he adopt a system that he learned somewhere else, or did he, I'm already going to guess that he's developed his own system through his own study.
Yeah, I think he's studied systems of healing, you know, all around the world. And, you know, what his house is, you know, one thing he told me about going to the library in South Jamaica, Queens, was like, before they made a book limit on the library, he used to take a shopping cart to the library.
Oh, my goodness. So wow.
This is someone with a voracious appetite for learning. And so I think he's integrated lots of different healing traditions, including Western medicine, to create his way of healing. And yeah, so his basement is a combination of computers and EKG machines to listen to both the circulatory system, the nervous system, and the heartbeat, and then tinctures and herbs and, you know, all kind of coexisting. You'll see wires passing through like a valerian root tincture on its way to an EKG machine. So he's integrating, you know, technology and plants and herbs to both diagnose and heal. And I think you're correct. I he'd speak better to this than me, so I don't want to kind of say exactly what his system is, but I think you're correct. It's a holistic system that's kind of been open to developing with a lot of influences.
And he has some very interesting things to say about the heart and the heartbeat that he talks about in the film. And he has studied and continues to study the heartbeat.
Indeed, yeah. The heart is another, you know, part of that central metaphor of kind of, you know, the way he talks about it in the film essentially is that when he first bought a record in the 60s, George Geckler's record of heart, recorded heartbeat sounds, he put it on at home and recognized immediately that all the secret rhythms and the possession rhythms and, you know, when you're inside drum culture, it's not unlike the Mantis situation where you may get shown a clave part for a year and you may not be able to get access to the deeper parts of the drum culture. And he was basically saying everything was in the heart, all the different rhythms around the world that he had heard were all contained inside the heart. The heart never beats the same, exactly the same way twice. It's the opposite of a metronome. It's repeating, but it's continually shifting. The heart beats just like a metronome. That's not good. So he's made this lifelong study essentially on heart audio. And I think a big difference with that is often when you get, you know, your heartbeat analyzed in a medical situation, they're just giving you the EKG, which is the two events, the beat, you know, the largest part of the wave is what you're hearing. But he's really recording this stuff with an electronic stethoscope as well. So he's got this large collection of heart audio, actual audio. So you're hearing all the valves. You know, you're hearing the heart as the way it kind of dances, and it's not just two beats. There's beats inside beats, and there's beats inside those beats. And he's kind of taking that and analyzing it and abstracting from it different ways of thinking about rhythm. So another big metaphor in the film that's also in the trailer is this idea of kind of throwing away the metronome and listening to your heart, which I think it operates as a great metaphor, and it also is actually very real. One of the first lessons I got from Professor as a drummer was to kind of sit down in the laboratory, have my heartbeat recorded, and proceeded over the next couple of weeks to give me a collection of CDs that were both my heartbeat recording, but also kind of sonifications that he was making with sine waves based on those recordings. And he said, just throw away the metronome, practice the beats, and change my life. You know, there's no doubt about it. This is powerful stuff that, you know, people talk about, you know, voice and music. You know, you say this person has a voice and this person doesn't have a voice. You know, the difference between, you know, you say someone's good technically, and then you say, well, someone has feeling. You know, the feeling part and the voice part, those are always the hardest things to teach. How do you help someone obtain a voice? Well, the traditional way in the music conservatory is here. You're going to practice all the time, and you're going to copy every great person in the history. And if you can get that done, and you're still successful, and you're still standing and not jaded, then that someday you're like, you're going to start writing music and start making a statement. But Milford's made a whole entire pedagogy based on helping people find their voice. And that's why when you meet students, even if they're not musicians, whatever field they're in, they're very powerful in that field. They have original ways of thinking in that field. And I think this idea of using your own body and your own sensorial experience and the sound of your own heart as the basis for a musical practice is a very, very powerful idea and very effective idea. And I think that's why you don't see Milford students that all sound like Milford. He doesn't have big collections of students that sound like him on the drum kit. But what he does have is a whole bunch, dozens and dozens of original thinkers who are kind of connected to their own vibration on us, where what they do kind of vibrates at a different frequency. And I think that is that idea of voice. So I think that's, as far as, you know, I've been Milford's student for 15 years, so that's something I actually can speak on, is that I feel that as a teacher, he's kind of focused all his creative energy as a teacher on figuring out how to help people become what they're supposed to be in an authentic way. And these are keys. The heart is a key, you know, especially if you're a drummer, your heartbeat is a key. And it was a key for him too. I mean, what he says in the film is no one can come to his house without having their heartbeat recorded. And he called all his drummer friends and said, we don't have to go around begging for these rhythms anymore. They're all inside of it. You know, and that's the powerful stuff. And this is like the embodied emergent thing I was talking about before. None of this stuff is like done to kind of like push people away or make a statement about, you know, some people talk about free jazz. It's like, you know, there's some sort of crisis or something. This was not Milford's statement. His statement was about emerging and growing new pathways, new brain pathways, neurological pathways to think in previously unthought of ways. And that's really why, you know, when I started studying with him and I started realizing what this was, I kind of recognize, and you put it all together with the discography and the career, and you realize, okay, this is somebody who's going to be looked at, you know, in the future and studied, you know, that if we have human civilization still in 500 years, they're going to be looking at both Milford's music, the things he was saying, and his body of research in a close way. And I figured, well, I better do my duty because I'm here. And create something. And I think when you do think back about the figures of history that you mentioned earlier, these dynamic people, you know, often, you know, for someone like Leonardo da Vinci, like, I would love to see what his laboratory looked like and the way he was thinking and talking. And that's ultimately, you know, that's ultimately why the film is focused on Milford's voice. So you have an hour and a half and to get the audience into that place where you can really feel the teaching, anything else would kind of knock you off a little bit, because you would start analyzing what you were. You would start listening to someone else's analysis of what you were experiencing rather than kind of going on that journey that the film invites you to go on.
Gotcha. And it's so interesting, the approach that he took to drumming, using his heartbeat as the source of knowledge, is so similar to how he approached martial arts. He was inspired by the idea that nature had been an inspiration to the ancients in martial arts. And so he said, well, I can do that too.
Yeah.
If they did it, I can do it. I love that attitude. It's really something that we all need.
No doubt. And I mean, I'd say he even took that further and this is like the body as nature, you know, and I think that's another thing we need, but like, not only will he talk about the ancients, you know, looking at nature and the master of praying mantis studying directly from the praying mantis itself, but he'll also take his studies of the human immune system, and he'll be developing practices inside Yara based on externalizing the immune system. And having, he'll talk about it as externalizing the immune system and having conversations, you know, having an arena to explore kind of the way nature works, to become more in tune with nature. And yeah, it's a powerful approach, and I agree with you. It is something we all need.
Yeah, because if you're waiting around for somebody else to tell you, or a person to tell you how it is, you may wait forever. For instance, going back to the martial arts, because it's such a vivid example, some of his colleagues and friends went down to China. And I know that experience, by the way. I know that it's still that way to a degree, but it definitely was that way in when I was growing up in the 70s and 80s. It was not, the information was not openly available. It was restricted. And then even if you got into a school, it was dished out, you know, one spoon at a time, with the teacher being the source. And so much of education and life is like that. And if I understand what one of the messages of Milford Graves is, no, it's there, right there. You know, nobody's keeping you from your own nature. You have to look.
Exactly.
You have to spend time with it. And it may be, you may feel lost at times. You may not know what direction to go, but if you keep coming back to the nature, and I love that point that you just send it briefly, but it's so important. We're nature too. Human beings are nature. And this is something that's really somehow gotten lost in the shuffle. And we think of nature as Mount Shasta or, you know, the Redwood Forest, and that's all nature too. But, you know, we're walking around nature.
Exactly. You know, the biome is in us too. And I would say that's a deep, deep part of the way the film is structured too. You know, there's this part of the film where he talks about the five-part harmony. He's talking about the five senses, the sensorum, you know, and that's the way our biome is in interaction with the rest of the biome that we're embedded inside. And I think, you know, in many ways, the film kind of approaches that access point you're talking about. Like, what do you have access to? Well, you always have access to your sensorum. You're always, you know, you might have a limitation and have a sense gone, but you're going to be touching, you're going to be smelling, you're going to be seeing, and you're going to be tasting. So, you know, this idea that you can build a creative cosmology based on your own sensorum, based on being engaged creatively with your sensorial experience, it's in almost every scene of the film. You know, if you if you examine the film through that idea of the five-part harmony, through the five senses, there's a lot there to unpack, I think. And I think that's ultimately, you know, what when you meet Milford, you see someone who's totally engaged all the time with sensory experience. And again, you know, that's like you were talking about before, when you look at the foundations of Western science, that's what it's about. Observing, you know, observing with your senses. And, you know, he's created a whole body of and catalog of music based on this, but also healing, martial arts, and gardening, herbalism. My whole entire life is based on that approach.
Yeah, and it's, for lack of a better word, confidence in one's self and one's own senses and one's own mind, and it's different from being dependent on, you know, will somebody give me the information or not? Can I afford to go to that school or not? The school's walking around with you all the time. I can see why he has had so many successful students, successful in a wide variety of fields, because the fundamental lesson is trust yourself, and not in a trite way, but you know yourself, trust yourself, have confidence in your ability to use your own senses, your own sense, to guide you.
Yeah, absolutely.
So we've talked about the film, and how can people who can experience this film, how can they get to it? I know you have a website.
Yeah, so the film opened in New York City on Friday at Metrographs. It's still playing there, four or five shows a day. They held it over another week. I just found out today. So it's going to play for another week at Metrographs, you know, starting this Friday. And so it'll be Friday to Thursday. If anyone's in the city listening to this now, I don't know when this is going to air, but I'll be down on Thursday to do a Q&A with Akash Mittal, a great sax player who also recently interviewed Milford for Bomb Magazine and Red Bull Music also, but a really fantastic writer and thinker, is going to be there to do both the introduction and the Q&A. And it opens in California at Lamley Beverly Hills in L.A. on the 27th, and also at the Roxy in San Francisco.
Okay. And
it'll be playing in cities all over. You can check the website, www.fullmantis.com. That'll have an always up-to-date screening list to see if it's playing at a city near you. There's probably about 15 or 16 cities booked now. And then, you know, after the theatrical run, I would predict probably later this year, you know, after Thanksgiving perhaps, the film will be available at first on iTunes and eventually on Amazon Prime.
Great. I think, you know, I would encourage people, this is the kind of film you want to see in the theater for a number of reasons. Number one, it's always more impactful, I think, to be in a big dark room with a big screen and no distractions to really immerse yourself in this. And it's a film you want to immerse yourself in. And secondly, I think it would be fun to see who else shows up to see a film like this. You know, you might meet somebody that you never would have met otherwise. It could be a very interesting social experience as well. Well, great. Well, I'm really grateful that you made this film. This is something that really needed to be done, should have been done. It has been done now, thanks to you. And it opens a window on human potential. And for people who are, all of our listeners are jazz fans. And, you know, it's also indicative of the fact that there's a lot of intelligence and ingenuity and courage behind every musician that attains something. And here's one film that gives us a window on a really extraordinary person who's taken a very extraordinary path. And he's basically has an approach to life which he's replicating by taking students on. And it doesn't matter what your particular field is, these things that he's discovered, these ways of being, ways of working, are applicable to any field that you could possibly want to go into. It reminds me kind of, you ever heard of Rudolf Steiner?
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, I mean, he's kind of Steiner-esque. Steiner, for people that don't know, is a guy who, well, actually, interestingly enough, one of Steiner's jobs as a young guy was to be the archivist of Goethe's scientific papers. And
wow.
Yeah, and I think it gave him, I guess, an inspiration to realize, hey, you know, you don't need anybody to give you permission to open your eyes and go deep into things. And so this is a great, great lesson that I can't speak enough about this whole experience of this film existing and Milford Graves and what he's doing. And thanks to the film, 50 years, 100 years, 200 years from now, people will see that there is this other way of approaching learning, this very profound way. So could you give the website address one more time?
Yeah, it's www.fullmantis.com. And
great.
You can contact me through that website. There's film booking. If you know if anyone's working at an art house theater or a cinema and wants to book the film, that you can do that through there. And then you can also link up with us on Facebook and Twitter and Instagram and all that stuff through the site as well. So, yeah, thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed the conversation.
Oh, pleasure's all mine, really. And maybe after the theatrical run, there could be a college run, because I think this would be such a marvelous film to show to people that are in school.
Yeah. We've already gotten some interest in that and started booking that way too. So.
Oh, great.
Yeah.
Great. Well, we've been talking with Jake Maginski, and the film is Full Mantis.
Full Mantis, indeed. Yeah.
Full Mantis, and about a remarkable human being. And I just strongly encourage everybody, find a way to see this film. It's something very, very unusual and important. And it'll make you even prouder of jazz and the whole jazz community than you already are when you see this one amazing individual that emerged in it, from it, and all the different directions he's taking his creativity. Well, thanks a lot, Jake.
Thank you, Ken.
We hope you enjoyed the podcast. If you did, please share it. That's how we grow. And remember to subscribe to jazzonthetube.com, the internet's largest collection of free, streamable, classic jazz videos.